Okay, since I ran out of time a little bit last time, I wanted to start just slightly early and try to just cover the last couple of slides of the previous lecture before we talk about what was originally scheduled for today. So basically, so we were talking about using lists and other data structures to program, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of other ways you can use term data structures in programs. So for example, you might define a phone book relation that has a list of entries, and maybe each entry is the first element is the person's name, and the second element is their phone number. So here, the number has actually got to be encased in single quotes to make it, to distinguish it from, you know, the term 123-4567. So that's just a string in there. And so, for example, you can define the standard kinds of table or map data structure operations. You can say, okay, if I have a phone book whose contents are the list B, then I can look up somebody's phone number by, or somebody, a person and their phone number by asking, okay, is there a member of the forum entry person name phone number in the list B, and then return that as P and N. And again, since this is really a relational definition, you can run this in sort of several directions. You can say, okay, I give you the phone book and I give you the person's name and you pull come back and give me the phone number, or you can say I give you the phone book and the phone number and you get the person's name, so sort of reverse phone book lookup. Similarly, for inserting something into the list, you just can glue it onto the beginning of the list, and for removing, you can use something that's essentially wrapping the list remove predicate that I showed last week. So similarly, we can define binary trees as just sort of recursive term data structures. So you might have trees where you have leaves or that don't carry any data, or nodes that carry some data X and then have a left and a right child T and U. And so for example, you can define a variant of the membership predicate for lists where you say, okay, if X is a member of a tree that starts with a node constructor that has X in it, or X is a member of a tree that starts with a node constructor that has some other thing Y, which may or may not be the same as X, as long as there's some subtree T or immediate subtree T or U of this node that contains X. So either X is a member of tree T, or semicolon, X is a member of tree U. Okay. So so building on this, if we have lists, we can say, okay, let's say we want to define a preorder traversal of all the node labels or the data values of the list. We can say, okay, start with the base case. So if the tree is a leaf, then there aren't any node values and the preorder traversal list is empty. And if it starts with a node, then, well, the preorder traversal basically is add the current node onto the list and then add the preorder traversals of the two subtrees in left to right order. So if we have a node XTU, then the return value, the preorder traversal return value is going to be something that starts with X and then has some list of things N, where N is obtained by appending together the two lists we get by traversing T and U. Okay? So at the bottom, I asked what happens if we run this in reverse, and I'll just sort of leave that as something to try on your own rather than demonstrate it here, because I really need to get to the material for this lecture. So that's just wanted to polish off those slides. Okay, so today in in today's lecture, we're going to start covering some of the non-logical features of Prolog that don't correspond directly to things in first-order logic, as you've been seeing in Alan's lectures, but are sort of necessary for actually writing practical programs in a lot of cases. So there's actually a number of things beyond what I'm going to talk about today. The three things I'm going to talk about today involve predicates or built-in operations that give you access to machine arithmetic instead of the kind of slow unary arithmetic that we talked about last week, and features that let you do input and output, or that let you have some control over the search process beyond just sort of letting the depth-first search run, okay? So Also, before we begin, somebody asked last week, and I realized I hadn't explained very well. Some of the predicates discussed so far as examples or that we'll discuss today really are built-in predicates in Prolog, sometimes with slightly different names. So I wanted to point out that they're there so that you don't have to redefine them yourself if you're programming. So we'll talk about a length predicate today that's actually built in and called length written out, which I'll call len. And the append predicate we discussed last time is also built in. And the mem predicate we discussed last time is called member, and that's also a standard built-in thing. So it's kind of good to know how to define these things from scratch, because they're sort of common programming patterns that you might want to adapt to other settings. But it's also kind of good to know that they're built in, because the built-in implementation might be a lot more efficient than the standard implementation written by hand. So the text we're using, the Learn Prolog Now book, has an index in the back that lists all the built-in Prolog predicates that it mentions in the book. And that's a superset of the predicates that you'll actually need to know, for example, in the programming exam. So the built-in predicates mentioned in that book include the ones that we'll be talking about in lectures, and I'll try to highlight when things are built in so that you'll know from now on. Okay, so so I mentioned what we're going to talk about today, and there's another important non-logical feature that really sort of takes up a whole lecture on its own involving negation. And this was discussed a bit in the tutorial last week, but we'll talk a lot more about the gory details of this next week. Okay, so far we've worked mostly in what is often called pure Prolog, so in particular the model theory and semantics in the theory series of lectures is really talking about the semantics of pure Prolog. And it has a nice basis in first-order logic, and often lets you write solution, or you know, describe your problem, and then tell the system to go off and find a solution. But often this isn't quite enough to do what you want. So in particular, you want to have access to machine arithmetic, and you want to have the program maybe interact with the outside world in some way. And also, the standard depth-first proof search technique is not always efficient, or maybe not always easy to control to keep it from going off into an infinite loop. So we might want to know how we can control the proof search behavior better. So first, let's look at expression evaluation. Let me just illustrate first. So Prolog has, I've mentioned this a couple of times in lectures already, Prolog lets you write things like 2 plus 2, and those are actually interpreted internally as terms with a function symbol plus and two arguments, 2 and 2. So it will let you say, okay, tell me if 2 plus 2 equals 4, and it will say, no, it's not. They're not the same thing, because from the point of view of the interpreter, you know, this side is a syntax tree with a plus at the top and 2 as children, and this side is just a single node with 4, okay? So they're not the same thing in terms of as abstract syntax trees. And moreover, if you ask what x is equal to 2 plus 2, it will just tell you, oh, it's 2 plus 2. What were you thinking? So we'd really like it to be able to do smarter things with arithmetic information. So for example, and we showed how to do this last week, we could define unary arithmetic or even binary arithmetic on abstract syntax trees, and then define predicates that let you evaluate these sort of built-in infix plus and minus and so on expressions as if they were numbers represented by this encoding. But this is very, 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 very slow. So this is basically, you know, instead of using a 32-bit word on a standard 32-bit machine or a 64-bit word on your you know, today's machines, this is going to be, you know, using a data structure with, you know, maybe order n or order log n memory cells to represent a number whose value is n. So this is, and if we wanted to do something like this with floating point arithmetic, this would be even worse. So you don't want to sort of be doing lots of memory allocation when you're just sort of adding two normal numbers together. So how can we get access to the built-in machine arithmetic in Prolog? Well, the traditional way of doing this is basically to just sort of bake in a special predicate that lets you that will interpret expressions in the right way. So instead of saying x equals 2.2, 2 plus 2, there's another built-in infix predicate that lets you say, okay, what is the, you know, that lets you say, take this term on the right-hand side and evaluate it as a arithmetic expression and give me the value and unify the value with this thing on the right-hand side. So is doing sort of evaluation on the right on the right-hand side and then unification of the value with the left-hand side. Sorry, I said that a little bit confusingly before. So in particular, we can say, okay, just demonstrate. So, you know, this evaluates X. This doesn't evaluate X, right? So, and so on. So that basically all the standard, you know, addition, multiplication, division, modular arithmetic, and certain other standard machine operations are provided just as built-in things that you can evaluate in this setting. However, this comes with kind of, so here are some more examples. Saying what I just said. The other thing is there's no sort of difference between integer types, integer number types and floating point number types here. So if you say, okay, take 42 and 5 and take 42 and divide it by 5, you're going to get a floating point number even though you started with integer numbers. So it's sort of going to internally cast things to whatever the appropriate, I think in general everything's sort of treated as floating point, but might be internally optimized to use integer arithmetic if the implementation determines that's safe. So so it's pretty high level. But the reason it's sort of included in this lecture about non-logical features is that it also kind of breaks the declarative abstraction of Prolog in that unlike the equality predicate, the is predicate, the evaluation predicate is asymmetric. So in other words, if you ask is, you know, x equal t, that's the same as asking if t equals x. But asking if x is, if some term is a variable, is not the same as asking if some variable is the term. Let me just demonstrate that dynamically. Right, so we can evaluate a complex term and get a number from that. But if we stick the complex term on the right-hand side, and evaluate that, then we get an error. And similarly, if we stick something that isn't really an arithmetic term on the right-hand side, then we'll also get an error. So basically, the right-hand side here is expected to be, first of all, ground, so there aren't any free variables in it. That is, you don't have to sort of, you know, it should have a single well-defined value at the point where you call this function. And second, where you call this predicate. And secondly, the function symbols and constants in it have to all be things that make sense as arithmetic expressions. Okay, so you can have numbers, and you can have addition, subtraction, multiplication, modular arithmetic, and a few other built-in things. But you can't, you know, define your own expression symbols to be used on the right-hand side. You have to sort of stick with the standard thing. So it's a little bit restrictive. And also this logical, there's sort of not a direct logical interpretation of this kind of, so the other way of saying this, explaining this problem with saying 2 plus 3 minus 1 is x is that really we have to give this a mode where the second argument, the right-hand side argument has mode annotation plus, so it always has to be ground when we get to that point. So just to sort of nail that point down a little bit further, we could do something like first bind x to 4 and then ask whether 2 plus 3 minus 1 is the same as the value of we get by evaluating x, okay? And let's see, why is that not true? And the reason is that 2 plus 3 minus 1 is still an uninterpreted term at this point. So if I want to get yes, I have to say x equals 4, 4 is x. Okay, so that works. But the reason this predicate damages the logical interpretation is that if we just take these two goals and solve them in the opposite order, then we'll get this instantiation error again, okay? So do you see what I mean by this? This is sort of saying, logically, these two goals are the same. This is saying, is there some x such that x is equal to 4, and 4 is what we get by evaluating x? And this is saying, is there some x such that 4 is what we get by evaluating x, and x equals 4? So it's just commutativity of and. But here we get a value, here we get a solution, and here we get an error. So these errors kind of break the declarative abstraction. There's kind of no error condition built into the semantics. Okay, so this, you know, like with other predicates involving that were discussed in the tutorial that have similar groundness constraints, these have to be, you may need to think more carefully about when things get down to terms when you use these predicates. Okay, so there's a trade-off getting access to more efficient built-in operations versus having to think more carefully about the program. Okay, so how can we combine this with the kind of recursive programming over lists that we already saw a lot of examples of last week? So for example, we can define a predicate that takes a list and calculates its length. Hopefully this is not rocket science, but let me just sort of spell it out. So if the list is empty, then the base case is the length of the list is 0, and the list, if the list is some list L with some other thing constant to the beginning, then the length is going to be n, where n is what we get by adding 1 to the length of the list L. Okay, so we evaluate length of L, get some length m that describes the length of the sublist, and then add 1 to it. So one slightly unfortunate thing about this is because of this issue with this groundness constraint, this length predicate is actually somewhat restrictive. It will tell you, if you give me a list that is at least, if the spine of the list, the top level constructors, the nil and cons constructors are ground, then I will be able to calculate the length of the list. But if you just give me the length and ask me to calculate, you know, the shapes of lists of length n, then this won't work. So you have to write a different predicate if you wanted to run this kind of operation in the reverse direction. So if you say, okay, I want a predicate that says, given n, construct the sort of skeleton of a list of length n, then this is what you would need to do instead. So this is really essentially the same, except we've reversed the order of the is predicate and made it into subtraction instead of addition. Okay, so we're saying, okay, if the length we wanted to of the list we wanted to construct is 0, then we'll give you the empty list. And if the length of the list you wanted to construct is n, then okay, first let's subtract 1 from n and build a list of length n minus 1, build a list of length m where m is equal to n minus 1, and take that and then stick an extra concell on at the beginning with the anonymous variable that just sort of will match anything. So this is really not building concrete lists of a given length, but it's giving sort of lists with free variables in it, a list of length n with n different free variables in it that will then sort of match any list of length n. Okay, so this, you know, in contrast to the length function, length predicate on the previous slide, this will work in the sort of reverse mode, taking the number and giving you a list, but not in the forward mode, taking a list and giving you a number. Somebody, I think, during one of the tutorials maybe asked me if it's possible to write functions that sort of dynamically test which mode they might be being used in and then behave appropriately. And it is actually possible to do this, but it's not something that we're going to cover in a lot of detail in the course. But for example, the built-in function, list length function, actually does work in both directions without sort of you're having to choose different choose a different implementation. So it is going to do this sort of dynamic check to see whether, you know, is the length of the list given? If so, then we can generate a list of the appropriate length, or vice versa. Okay. So continuing in this vein, here's a kind of standard, you know, this is a problem of roughly the size and complexity that you might see in, say, one of the first or second problems on a programming exam, that's sort of saying, okay, given a list, try and calculate the sum of all the elements of the list. So, you know, again, the simple case is the list is empty, so there aren't any elements, so the result is zero. And the second case is the list starts with something, so first what we do is calculate the sum of the elements in the tail of the list, and there's a typo here, so this L should be, this M and this M should be, oh, there's lots of, never mind, everything's fine. Okay, so this list is starts with X and has tail L, and so we'll calculate the sum of all the elements in the tail L, and we get M. And then to calculate the sum of all the elements of the overall list here, we calculate the sum of M and the element we just cons on X. Okay. So, just as a kind of quick check, let's think about what the right mode description for this predicate is. Does anybody have a suggestion? Yeah, so it's really kind of doing the same kind of work as the length function. It's saying, okay, if the first element is completely ground, then we're going to be able to do something and give you a ground answer in the second part. And if the first part isn't completely ground, then we might get stuck because we might not be able to fill in this, so for example, if one of the x's isn't a ground term, or even if it isn't a number, then if we plug it in here, then this is predicate will get stuck, either because of the instantiation problem or the domain problem. Okay, so you usually not only have machine arithmetic operations, but also relations such as less than, greater than, and equality, inequality, and lots of variations on this theme. So these are all available as part of Prolog as well. They're all actually available as built-in predicates. You don't have to use them combined with the is operation, but they have a kind of similar behavior. So so for example, we can say, is one equal, is one equal colon equal two minus one. So this operation is, its semantics is basically assume both this side and that side are expressions and evaluate them to some value and then test whether they're equal values. Okay, so unlike equals, right, unlike equals, this is allowing expressions with different shapes to be evaluated to the same to values and then compared, but unlike is, this equal colon equal operation is really symmetric, as you know, for whenever it's defined, it's going to if the left hand side evaluates the same thing as the right hand side, then if you reverse the order of the left and right hand side, they'll still both evaluate to the same thing. But like is, it's going to have constraints such as that both sides have to be completely ground and both sides have to be things that make sense as expressions, okay? And then the same goes for less than and greater than and less than or equal and so on. Okay, so that's really just a variation on the theme of is that we've been talking about so far. And so the constraint really can be summarized as the mode of all of these relations is plus plus, so both arguments have to be ground. Okay, so then, but then we can use these to define other operations on top of these relations. So we can define a max predicate that takes two ground things and checks whether whichever one is larger we're going to return, and maybe if they're equal, then it doesn't matter which one we return. So I think I've loaded the code for that in already, but let me just check. Yeah, so if I say, okay, what's the max of 1 and 2, then I get 2. And if I say, what's the max of 2 and 2, then I get 2. And if I say, if I say, for what x's is x the max of 2 and x? Well, logically, that should really be something like, okay, any x bigger than 2, bigger than or equal to 2 would satisfy that. But operationally, it's going to run into this less than or equal to 2 constraint with a variable and then complain and say, okay, one side of that was not ground, so I don't know what to do. Okay? Right, so we'll come back to max and similar things a little bit later, but first I just want to tell you what the basic facilities for input and output are, just so that you know they're there if you want to write programs that, that do something other than sort of respond to queries interactively. So let me actually just do this interactively. Okay, so basically this little program here, so the three basic predicates I'm going to demonstrate are read, which takes takes a term that could be a free variable or could be a value, and reads in a term using prolog syntax from the standard input from the terminal, and the term has to be terminated by a period so that the system knows when to stop reading. And write, which takes a ground term and prints it out as a term, and something called NL, which or new line, which basically just prints a carriage return out to the terminal. And so with this, we can use the built-in machine arithmetic predicates we've already been talking about, and the IO predicates here, and write a simple calculator program. Okay, so this, I mean, already Prolog itself is kind of, you know, doing this, but this is a this is sort of just to demonstrate the I/O features. So this program is going to basically be an atomic predicate symbol calc, which says, okay, to calculate something, let's read something in and bind it to x, and then whatever x is, we'll evaluate that and bind the result to y, and then we're going to write the term where that starts with the equal function symbol, and the right-hand side, the left-hand side child is x, that is the term that we've evaluated, and y is going to be the value of the term. And then we'll print out a new line, so this NL predicate prints out a new line. And then we'll keep going, we'll keep calculating things as long as people provide things to calculate. Okay, so if I do that, then I can say, okay, well, what's 1 plus 2? And it'll say 1 plus 2 equals 3. And so I can say, okay, and I can do some more complicated thing, and sort of keep going in that vein. And I've put a semicolon in there where I didn't need one, so it's complaining. But just to demonstrate what's going on. So I mean, basically, that's really it as far as the sort of simple term-based input and output goes. But if you know, all you really want to do is load in a bunch of data stored as Prolog terms from a file or something like that, then this is pretty much enough. But again, the I/O features, well, as you might guess just from looking at things like the new line predicate, right? These I/O features really kind of completely break the declarative model because they're having side effects on the rest of the world. Okay, so the new line predicate, you know, it logically should have some value, true or false, but operationally, it's always going to succeed, and it's always going to have a side effect that prints out a new line, and that sort of, you know, means that doing well. First of all, the order of evaluation, you know, really matters. Even modulo the recursion here, the order of evaluation really matters here. If we did this is before we did the read, then it would blow up, right? It would complain because the x wouldn't be bound when we do the evaluation. So basically, this is, you know, the kind of programming that you typically will do at the sort of top level, you know, main loop of the program, and hopefully not too much of in the middle of the program, just to sort of build a frame for interfacing the program with the outside world. So in particular, we've talked a bit about backtracking, but in some sense, so backtracking, you know, the proof search behavior lets you find lets you will sort of search through all possible solutions in a systematic way, and when you reach a failure point, it will backtrack and undo the choices you've made. But it can't sort of go back in time and undo the fact that you printed out "Hello World" or printed out a new line or something like that. And it especially can't sort of undo the fact that you read something in. So these are interactions with the outside world that basically are just kind of there's no attempt to kind of reconcile these with the backtracking behavior. So in particular, you might it might be surprising that basically, for example, if you say, let's write something and then evaluate the fail predicate, which always says fail, no answer, okay? Then allow an alternative. Okay. And then allow an alternative solution that involves writing something else. Well, then both, basically what's going to happen is we'll start off by saying, okay, how can we solve write of foo? Well, we can print out foo and then succeed. Okay, so that succeeds. And then this is an and. So we've solved this side, and now we need to solve that side. This fail predicate will always say fail, give up, go back, and backtrack. So it will backtrack and then say, okay, well, we could have instead done this write on the other side of this disjunction here. So let's just do that and succeed, and then we're at the end of the goal and we're done, so we're happy. We print out, yes, we succeeded. But similarly, we can, while we can't sort of undo the fact that we read something from the input, we can at least undo what we know about what we read from the input. So for example, if we say read something in and call it X and then give up, and then maybe read X again, what's X going to be? Well, if I say 1, 2, 3, okay, well, there's a syntax error there, but basically this is going to ask me to write, to put in two terms, and it's just going to ignore the second one, ignore the first one and return the second one bound to X, okay? So this X here gets bound to 1, 2, 3, but then when we fail, we backtrack up and it gets unbound. So you can see that that's what happened if I say, okay, read X and then write it out again immediately and then fail. If I do 1, 2, 3 and then 4, 5, 6 again. Okay, so after I wrote in the first 1, 2, 3, it got printed out right away, and then I put in 4, 5, 6 and it got bound to X. Okay? So this is just really kind of a warning that, you know, the sort of IO behavior doesn't behave logically at all, and so interleaving between sort of IO behavior and things like backtrack or search is a fast way to generate hard to find bugs. Let me put it that way. Okay, so I'm going to stop and ask if there are any questions so far, because I'm going to change gears entirely at this point. No? Okay. So there's the third sort of non-logical feature that I wanted to cover today is something called cut. And the motivation for the cut operation is that sometimes when you're writing a program, you know that at this point, I don't want to consider any of the other choices that might be pending for this rule or for this, disjunctive choice between subgoals. So this is called sometimes committed choice behavior. So we want to say, okay, at this point, look at the stack of other opportunities and throw some of them away, because maybe because they're sort of really going to describe the same solution, and we don't want to waste time searching through those other alternatives later. So if we just stick to pure prologue, there's no real way to say, ignore other alternatives at this point. You sort of have to let the system sort of has to try all the other possibilities. So in the sort of impure extension of prologue, that pure prologue that we're looking at now, that is in real prologue, there's a operation called cut that's just written as an exclamation mark, that is a prune search, pruning operator. So let me give you an example of where you might, the kind of situation where you might want to use this. So you might want to write, so we had this list membership predicate that we talked about last time, and there's also a built-in version of this. So you might want, if there's multiple occurrences of X in the list, and you just want to know whether X is in the list or not, you might want to, the system to just sort of find the first occurrence and then succeed, and if and not sort of keep finding all the other occurrences if, for example, there's some backtracking that asks for alternative solutions. So that is, if all we care about is whether X is present in L, then it's kind of pointless to say X is in L, you know, in five different ways rather than just once. Okay? So here's how we would do that. So if we say, okay, if you can solve the goal member X list by finding X at the beginning of the list, then solve the goal cut and stop. Okay, so what this is, this exclamation point is really from the point of view of the syntax, is really a sort of predicate symbol, a constant predicate. And it will always succeed when you run it, but it will have a side effect on the state of the proof search. So operationally, what this will mean is, say X is, well, I think I have an example on the next slide, so let's show it, right? Okay, so just by way of example, so in the proof search tree as I've been showing so far, each node is basically a point where we might make some choices. So for example, a node labeled with a sequence of predicates, you know, we might need to make a choice as to which rule to use to resolve against the first predicate in order to make progress. So how cut works is, when we encounter a cut, the proof search engine is going to look at all the alternative choices that have been that could have been made instead of the current choice at the last choice point, and it's going to blow them away and discard them, and they won't be revisited. They won't be visited if there's ever any backtracking through the cut. Okay, so it's complicated, and it's basically, we're going to look at a huge number of examples for the rest of the day, because it's really, you know, really breaks the logical interpretation. So here's how the membership predicate would work without cut. So we'd say, okay, let's see whether one is a member of 1, 2, 1, and we have these two rules. So we'll say, okay, let's see. Okay, rule one applies. So let's use that, and we're done. X was equal to one. We use this rule with X bound to one. That worked. Or if somebody says, okay, what other solutions are there? We might backtrack and say, okay, well, instead we could have used rule two with X bound to one, and with L bound to the list 2, 1 here, and then we get this choice point member 1, 2, 1, with this pending goal that we want to solve. And now how do we solve this? Well, now we have to use, if we use rule one, we can't make any progress because one and two don't match. But we can use rule two again and say, okay, well, X bound to one and L bound to the list containing one, rule two applies. And now we just need to solve member one, list containing one. And now rule one applies and we're done. Okay. And if we tried to use rule two to solve this, we'll get stuck again. So there are two solutions, this one and that one. Okay? So if we use the cut rule, then basically, sorry, this stuff should have been invisible. Basically, when we solve using the first rule, we'll use the cut rule. When we solve the cut rule, this will succeed, and we'll also blow away these alternative choices that we could have otherwise used if there was some failure or backtracking requested here. So if we use the cut rule, then we'll just find one solution, and it will be based on the fact that X was, the thing we're looking for was found at the beginning of the list, the one was found at the beginning of the list. Right. Okay, so here's a larger example that I think is really based on something in the textbook that demonstrates what happens if we put cuts in to different points in a program. Okay, so we have here some, you know, complicated but kind of contrived program that says, okay, predicate P of XY holds if Q of X holds and R of XY holds, and P of XX holds if A of X holds, Q of X holds if A of X holds, and R of X holds if B holds of X and C holds of Y, and then some basic facts about A, B, and C. Okay, so I don't want to go through every step of this, but basically this is the complete proof tree for all solutions to P of X, Y. Okay, so this is saying, okay, well, we could either use this first rule that says P of X, Y is Q of X and R of X, Y, and then use the rule for Q to decompose the first part, and then use the rules for A here to make this first choice, and then simplify using then use the rule for R to transform this into B and C, and then solve the B against this and the C against this, and we get two solutions. Or similarly, if we, you know, there's another alternative we can explore with A bound to 3, and then there's no solutions there. And also, we could have used this rule P of XX up here, so we could have gone and sort of looked for solutions based on A, and then there are two solutions there. Okay? So what happens if we stick a cut into, for example, this part here, where we have Q of X, then cut, and then R of X, Y? Well, basically, this is going to say, so this cut occurs in this rule, a rule for this goal here. So the cut is going to apply to alternative choices that could apply to solving this goal. Okay, so the way we sort of model this behavior in the proof search tree notation is we stick the cut in as another subgoal to solve, and sort of keep track of, notice that basically the cut gets into the goal at this point. So we'll start solving the other things in front of the cut, and then when we get to the cut, we'll say, okay, look at all the alternative possible choices hanging off the proof search tree between this point and the point back here where the cut was introduced, and blow those away. So basically, at this point, we're now committed to exploring the proof search tree under here, and then ignoring this stuff, but maybe possibly exploring alternatives that were available earlier in the tree. Okay, so if we put a cut in here, then we'll basically just get these two solutions with X being 1 and Y being 2 or 3. Whereas if we put a cut in further down the tree, further into the predicate here, if we put it in at the end, then the place we'll start cutting off alternatives from will be the same, because we introduced it in the same place. But the scope of the cut will be wider. So we'll also remove this alternative here, the y equals 3. So this is sort of saying, okay, basically, when we're looking for a solution to P, if we can find one using Q and R, then take the first one and commit to it, and don't try this alternative rule here. Okay, so if we introduce the cut in this rule Q that's saying, okay, we can solve Q by finding something matching A, if we make the commitment to that solution there, then the cut is going to be introduced at this node, at this transition, rather than this transition. So even though kind of the place in the proof tree where the cut gets read is the same as in the first example, the scope is different. So this is going to remove the alternative solutions that we could have found to the R, to the Q subgoal, to the Q subgoal, but not the alternative that we could have found to P using the second rule here. Okay? Let's see, this is the last example based on this slide. So finally, if we put a cut into, say, the middle of this rule R here, then we'll say, okay, really this is going to say, if we find any partial solution involving solving B of X, then commit to that and try to solve using C of Y. And if the solution involving C of Y doesn't work, then don't try any alternatives for don't try any alternative possibilities for either B or any other rules for R if there were any. So there aren't. So in particular, since at this point we know that B would have to be 1, we already had B bound to 1. This doesn't really make any difference to the proof search tree. So there are situations where either because of the way the program is or the basic facts are, where the cut won't actually have any effect on the proof search. So now let's look at this max predicate again that I talked about a few slides ago. So here we have two rules, right? We have max that says, the first rule that says if x is less than or equal to y, then return y, and if x is greater than y, return x. Okay, so now there's basically, if this first rule ever applies, then we know the second rule is mutually exclusive, right? You can't be both greater and less than or equal to something. So it's kind of pointless to try to use, once we've succeeded using this rule, it's kind of pointless to try to use this rule to make another solution. So this is an example where we can put a cut into the program and it doesn't change the logical or the operational behavior of the program. It doesn't change the solutions that you'll get, but it may improve the efficiency. So this is kind of a good example of using cut that basically cuts away parts of the proof tree that were always going to either fail or give you the same solution anyway. But it's also it's also kind of tempting to say, okay, well, also we've already done this comparison x and y, and so why don't we just get rid of the part of the second rule that says check that x is bigger than or equal to y, and since basically if you read this as okay, check if x is less than or equal to y and then commit to that, and otherwise try this, then it's sort of maybe wasted work to check that that x is bigger than y at this point, because we'll only ever get to this part if x is bigger than y. But actually, that's kind of not very good for making the meaning of the program transparent. You have to think hard about about the behavior of cut to know what the program really does. And secondly, it now makes the rule order matter even in the case where there isn't any recursion. So if we'd said, okay, if we had the max rule first instead of, if we had the second rule first, then basically this would allow both max of 1, 2, 1 and max of 1, 2, 2 to succeed, even though that's sort of not what we want. So, let me just show you. So this is the normal max predicate, and here I've made another version of it using cut. And actually, let me just check something. Right, so this actually illustrates that the max predicate is kind of broken already, even if you don't exchange the order of the rules, because it's sort of really also expecting x and y to be non-ground, and the first two arguments to be ground, and the third argument to be non-ground. Okay, so if all three arguments are ground, so for example we have 1 and 2 and 1. Then we'll try, okay, does this match 1, 2, 1? Well, it doesn't, so we'll fall through this to this rule. So there's nothing that says that forces this first rule to apply. There's nothing that forces the second rule to apply only when x really is the max of the first two arguments. This definition kind of bakes in an assumption that you're calculating the third argument from the first two, not checking that the three arguments are consistent. Okay, so I think I said this already, but basically there are plenty of situations where using cut can make the program more efficient by avoiding pointless backtracking. And there are also plenty of situations where adding cuts can change the meaning of the program and maybe make it not really make sense. So there's sort of a conventional